All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck sticks? What the fucksters? What the fuck holics? What the fuckadelics? How are you? Hi. Hi, it's Mark Maron. I'm losing my mind. Chrissy Hynde is on the show today. I had a lovely chat, an engaged and intense chat with Chrissy Hynde that you will hear momentarily. Obviously, she's from the band The Pretenders and now is doing some of those much-loved songs on the road a bit, but also touring on her new album, Stockholm. It's her first solo album. It was released in the summer. It's a great record. And you can see her actually live here in Los Angeles this Saturday at the Pantages. I may be there. I may be there. Oh my God. I'm not great. Things are not I'll be honest with you what's happening. I didn't do any coffee today and I did not eat any nicotine today. And the day I'm recording this, it's well into the afternoon. Okay, I know I don't want to shatter your idea that we're all, you know, walking together or exercising together and that this is happening in real time, but it's 2:30 the day I'm recording this, which is yesterday. And every cell in my body is wondering what the fuck is happening. Every cell is like, we're not used to operating without the juice. Can we have some of the stuff? Can we have some of the chemical stuff? Where's that stuff you usually eat? Where's both of those compounds? We're shutting down, man. That's every cell in my body. It's also going like, all right, you're going to fuck with us? We're going to fuck with you. That's the other side of the cellular conversation. Yeah, keep this up. Keep it up. Sure, keep denying us what we want, and we're going to make you very aggravated and perhaps make somebody you love cry. That's what we're going to do. We're going to get together on a cellular level all throughout your body, including your brain, and we're going to seek out your loved ones and make them cry using you as a vessel if you deny us this nicotine and caffeine, you fuck. So that's what's going on with me. I'm having tea. It's interesting when you want to do the addicting thing. Like I was getting prepared to do this and talk to you, and my body was crawling, which is crawling with the need to take, like right now, I'm like, why isn't there one in my mouth? It's so fascinating, fucking addiction. Because I'm strung out on that shit, dude. I don't even want to really think about how much of those nicotine lozenges I'm doing. It's a lot, so my body is screaming for some relief. And that's what's going on in my body. And it's very hard for me to keep thoughts together, which is not great for this, not great for radio. Please, Mark, just give us a fucking nicotine lozenge. For God's sakes, man, what are you trying to prove? Go make some coffee and get a lozenge in your mouth. What the fuck, Captain? Who's in charge of this vessel? Feed us. Sorry, that was my the leader of my cells, who will speak through me occasionally. Oh, please, please. We're going to do something stupid. We're going to do something stupid, man. If you look, okay, look at, you see this little cell? I'm going to kill it if you don't get us what we need. Please, Mark. One nicotine lozenge. Just do one. You can do one, man. You can just do one. Just have a half. And that'll be it. Just do a half. And then I'll be good. Well, I'll be good in here. Well, I'll be good with just a half, right? Right, you guys? Just a half. Yep. Everyone's nodding yes. Just give us a half. I can't do it. I got to go for a day without it. Why, you fuck? Come on, man. Come on. Just relax. Let's just go through a day. But then it's going to be, everything's going to be normal. And then it's just like, what happens when we want to feel good? We just sort of like, oh, how can we make ourselves feel good? And we just kind of go like, I guess nothing. I guess no way. Please relax. If we could just get through 3 days, I think we'll all feel more comfortable. But who wants that? I want to feel juiced now. I want to feel jacked. I want to feel like we're engaged in the world. And relaxed at the same time. Just do a half. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. Can you relax? I'm going to do an advertisement now. No! Just give us a quarter. Please. So I'm still recovering from Thanksgiving. I think you should know that. I'm not even sure it's all out of me. I was on Conan last night, or the night before last. I'm sorry I didn't let you know. I forgot to let my mother know. I forgot it was on my agenda. I forgot it was part of the plan. You can go watch it. I talked a little bit of, you know, I did jokes. There's some stuff there you guys probably haven't heard, but I'm sorry. I'm sorry, friends, that I did not alert you. Maybe if you were eating nicotine lozenges right now, you would be a normal person that you could talk like a person to your fans and listeners. Just give us one. I can't do it. I can't do it. You fuck. Come on. I'm uncomfortable and I'm not enjoying it. All right, just relax. We'll get through this. So what's been going on since Thanksgiving? Well, we had a little tragedy here at the house. And I feel like you're a little out of the loop with that, too. There was a cat coming around years ago, a brown and white cat. Who cares? Just one lozenge. Why are you doing this? It doesn't make any sense. Just, can't we just live our lives like we used to? Just one lozenge. You're just going to have to excuse him. So there was this cat coming around. This cat came around maybe, it's been in and out for about a decade, but never hung around that often, but I'd see it occasionally. It's a brown and white cat. It showed up at the house on the deck probably about, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago, and it did not look well, but I didn't know what to do with it. It was eating, I was feeding it. But it didn't look well, and this is a wild cat. And then I started to realize, well, it's dying. It seems to be dying. I don't know if it's old. I don't know if it has the AIDS, the feline AIDS, but it was beyond help. It was emaciated. It was having trouble breathing, but it was calm, and I was feeding it. But there was no way I could trap it because it wasn't eating enough to get him into a cage, and I couldn't grab it. So, you know, I just kept feeding it and giving it water and treating it as well as I could. And in hopes that it might turn around. And over the course of about a week or so, I noticed that, like, he didn't have really any teeth and he was not able to really breathe that well. But I just kept giving him food and sometimes he'd eat it. But he passed away when I was in Florida. And my friend Sarah, who was watching my house, had to deal with that, but said he died very peacefully. But it's so sad when things die. If you had a nicotine lozenge right now, you could deal with grief. Nothing would matter. Please stop. So we lost that guy. But my guys, everything's pretty good at the house. But there's sort of a cloud of loss around. He was under the house is where he was. He was living under the house, riding out the last week or so of his life. Oh, sad. Sad. Oh, God. I want it. Okay. All right. Stop. 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 Pull it together. Don't feed that voice. So, yeah, a little post-mortem. Is that what we call it for Thanksgiving? Things went well, but I was ready to leave. I was certainly ready to leave. And as I said, I'm not sure it's all out of me. So I've been kaling. I've been doing the healthy thing. I've been on a cereal cleanse. That's where you get many cereals. Bran Buds, Bran Flakes, Puffins perhaps, and you just eat that for 2 or 3 days until your colon is spick and span. That's my theory. I've never heard of anyone talk about the cereal cleanse, but certainly I encourage it. Cereal cleanse. Maybe I invented it. I had a great time talking to Chrissy Hynde. We did start out talking about S. Clay Wilson, who we are both a fan of and who has, you know, hit some hard times physically. I think I told you about S. Clay Wilson. The website, sclaywilsontrust.com, because he does need some help. And Chrissy Hynde is right there on the front of it, talking to S. Clay. She loves him. So that's what we started talking about, that man, Chrissy. If you weren't clear who he was, he's one of the great dark wizards of the underground comic art. One of the originals. Checker Demon, baby. Yeah. So you're going to have to forgive me, my scatteredness. Because, but I think, you know, if I get through these few days, I'm going to really level off.
Oh, my God. What a bore. Jesus Christ. Do everyone a favor. Just have a nicotine lozenge. You're putting me to sleep and I'm inside of you. Oh, God, Mr. Excuses. Just give us the drugs, you fuck.
Okay. All right. That's enough of that guy. Huh? No, it's not. All right, stop. All right. Look, can we? I got to talk to Chrissy Hynde and you. We're just let's just keep it together. All right. Let's now go to my conversation with Chrissy Hynde. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
End. Do I need headphones? No.
Not if you don't want to. I mean, it's not a requirement unless you want them.
Well, why would I want them?
Some people can regulate their voice better.
Oh, should I do that?
Nah, just pull the mic into your face and I think you'll be fine. Some people know how to talk.
I don't know how to talk.
But you don't have to wear them if you just keep the mic close to your face.
Do most people use them?
Yeah, a lot of people do.
Well,
but you don't have to. You sound
most
good.
People?
I'll let you know. If you're fading.
Okay, I mean, I won't use them anything if I don't have to.
You're good.
Okay. I don't need my glasses either, do I?
No, you don't need,
Okay.
It is an honor to meet you, Chrissy Hynde.
Thank you. Likewise.
Here's the weird thing, is I was listening to the new record, and on the song, which song was it? Adding the Blue? You brought up S. Clay Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
How much did you love S. Clay Wilson? Why'd you add
a whole lot.
Right?
Yeah.
When you first saw S. Clay Wilson, didn't it blow your fucking mind?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, my nickname was Bernice at one point.
Oh, for the character?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one that got the cum fix, who had the penis tattoo on her. Yeah. On her arm. The wish I had one tattoo.
Do you remember, like, when was the first time you saw that guy's stuff?
Oh, you know, Zap Comics.
Back
and
in-
then I was doing a show, obviously, many years after that, 30 yeah. years after, somewhere in San Francisco, and it was Valentine's Day, a radio uh-huh. show. So I said, oh, S. Clay Wilson, won't you be my Valentine? And I think someone that worked with him told him that. So then he, you know, sent me a message. So, of course, I was thrilled.
Yeah, did he send you a little checkered demon with the message?
He sent me some comic books and stuff.
Really?
Yeah, and then I've seen him when I've gone out there. He's come to the show, so.
Yeah,
but yeah, huge fan.
Yeah, he's like, because I'm going to, I need to, he's not well. Right now, and I want to move some.
No, he's not well, but he's not dead.
No, he's not dead, but he's.
And but he, he was a huge influence on me, because he came at a time when that biker culture hadn't gone underground yet.
Right.
You know, they hadn't brought in the RICO law to get rid of the mafia, so they hadn't really got rid of the real criminal element of that biker culture, which. At that time, in the end of the 60s, mid to end of the 60s was a real heyday for those bikers because, you know, there was all these hippie chicks who, you know, and everyone was having sex and taking birth control. And so it was like a free for all. And you were supposed to do all that.
Right.
And, you know, on acid, you probably did. And, you know, the whole idea was not to be inhibited.
Right.
Because that was part of being free. And it was on the back of beat poetry. And we were reading all that stuff. So these bikers... It was they really cleaned up.
Yeah.
And
fucking a biker on acid might be the last thing you do with your freedom.
Well,
in your mind.
You had to be careful with those guys.
Yeah.
And but S. Clay, of course, reading his stuff, because he was a biker. You know, he had a Harley back, I guess, you know, he was probably, when was he born? Around, he was probably riding his bike. Where was he from? Oklahoma, I think.
I'm not sure.
And so he was a biker probably in early 50s. He was a little older than me. And so he kind of glamorized it much the way that Robert Crumb sort of was, you know, it sort of documented the whole.
Oh, yeah.
The whole culture.
Right. In all its insanity at the time.
Yeah, all of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wasn't really a hippie himself.
Right.
You know, he was more of a nerdy guy. You know, he was
a lot
really,
of them were like that.
Yeah.
There was a lot of those guys that were documenting it that were
I think cartoonists probably generally were because they were kind of intellectuals, but they had a, you know, with an artistic thing.
And they had to get their work done. They were the only ones sitting there drawing things. I mean,
yeah, and compulsive. And, you know, they're pretty nutty. But S. Clay really, I don't know if I would say he did a disservice to girls like me, but he, you know, sort of had the language and the whole thing that, you know, was a turn on to a young girl and all that biker culture and the checker demon and all the dyke pirates and everything. But, you know, it was a dangerous thing to get involved in if you actually did get involved.
Right.
And if you were in Cleveland and places like I was, it was easy to access that sort of stuff. And there were the security guards at all the, you know, cool bands. So they were around.
When you were like 18, 17?
Yeah, younger than that even.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, yeah, you kind of got a taste through S. Clay, but, you know, if you really went in there, then that's not an easy thing to get back out of.
Yeah, I find that about a lot of things, about where, you know, certainly drug culture and a lot of times that the people who were like, I'm going to fucking do it and experience that, some things are really hard to come back from.
Well, yeah, drug addiction is
hard.
You know, alcoholism is bad to come. I mean, a lot of things. I mean, even people, promiscuity, just becoming too many choices and getting too loose with your whole, having no structure, just, you know. And that was really the thing then. It's gone very conservative now. But what I think the aftermath of a lot of that behavior is kind of not being able to stick to the plan, not being able to commit to anything because there's, you know, a kind of a free-for-all of choice.
Yeah, and also you kind of like you lose sense of your own self-parameters.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you're sort of like, you know, who am I? If you annihilate yourself with all these choices, eventually you're like, I'm just a beat up, broken mess.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know, that's absolutely true. And so, I mean, I see it all around me and, you know, I also am trying to not be a beaten up, broken mess.
Well,
but,
thank God you have a point of view and a voice and you can, you know, manage a guitar and you have a thing. I mean, if you have a thing, you can hold on to yourself a little bit better.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But I still feel that if I represent anyone, and I think anyone does who's in the public eye or making music or doing your thing, you know, I definitely represent, you know, people who are in their 60s, divorced, you know, waitresses or, you know, divorcees, people, single parents, people who have limped along and tried to get through it.
Yeah.
I don't represent, you know, successful, you know, people who were after the money and who were after. I still feel my kinship is to the, I don't even know what it's called anymore.
Rugged independence.
It used to be anti-establishment,
right?
And that kind of doesn't even in the music culture now. It's all about the establishment. So I'm kind of lost in it myself. I don't know really.
That other stuff. I mean, as a woman and as a role model, you know, all that stuff. I think your determination and your ability to transcend a lot of. You know, I don't know if I'd call it tragedy, but certainly within the band there was that. But then the heartbreak of just getting older and all that stuff. I mean, you still, you know, you persevere.
That's not heartbreaking. Getting older, No.
Just having weathered divorces and stuff. There's heartbreak in life, and you can't avoid
that.
Yeah,
there is, but there's none more. There's no more for me than for an estate agent.
That's absolutely true. So how do you think, like, when you first, you know, came out of, where'd you grow up in? Which part of Ohio?
Akron.
And you still have a place there?
No.
No? Are you done with Ohio?
No, I did have a vegan restaurant there, which was very successful, but I wasn't, you know, I didn't set it up right. I wanted something as my parents were getting older to engage myself with when I was there, but I went against the advice of all my advisors who, you know,
right.
I was the only investor. I didn't know anything about restaurants, but I did it anyway. Yeah,
yeah,
that's what everyone told me.
Right.
And it did go under, and but to anyone that went there, it thought it was a big success. But,
right.
You know, like the fellow that was supposed to be managing it, like, didn't pay taxes and stuff like that. So it kind of went under.
There's a lot of rogues in the restaurant business. It's like the rock business.
There's
a lot of guys undercover somehow, avoiding some stuff.
But I take responsibility because I set it up. And I'm, you know, it's very easy to try to do something. And then when it doesn't work out, you know, I think a lot of people will always find excuses why it didn't work for them. But, you know, I always will take the responsibility that, you know, I got myself there and it didn't work out. And I didn't manage it properly.
Yeah.
It was down to me in the end.
Yeah. But it was a good restaurant, from what I understand.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was really great. It was called the Vegetarian. And, you know, I'd still like to do one. But next time I would make sure I had people in place that knew what they were doing.
Get some other people's money.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, I took a real kick in the teeth myself. But in Akron, they probably thought I was rolling in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, that's what it's like when you go back to I'm not going to say a small town. Akron wasn't a small town. But, you know, when you leave a place and then you come back and you try to put something into the community and get back into the downtown and give it some, you know, people still see you as a little bit of an outsider, and I'm not too sure how much they appreciate it.
So it was part of a thrust to sort of reinvigorate the downtown of
Akron. Definitely.
Right.
That was part of my whole...
Did that succeed at all? I haven't been
to
Akron.
Well, yeah, it did, because Akron, like all those other American cities, just collapsed when Cleveland, Detroit,
yeah, sure.
You know the story. You know, the industry collapsed, and then for a whole lot of other reasons that, you know, we could talk about for hours.
Sure.
Everyone bailed out of the city, and... You know, the train stations closed down. There was no public transport to speak of, unless you're... And it just... Everyone bailed out to the suburbs and it became the mall culture.
Yeah.
So I went back and tried to put my restaurant in the downtown and tried to say, come on, everyone, let's go. I get on the bus and I get the local paper, the Akron Beacon Journal, and say, come on, public transport's for everyone.
Yeah.
And everyone was like standing there going, no, it's not. And I was like, no, come on, it is.
I'm sorry. But you championed it. You put yourself out in
front
of it.
I tried.
Well, what's interesting to me is because of where you're at and what you grew up in, last night I watched a documentary on the MC5 and, you know, Cleveland, Detroit and a lot of those bigger industrial cities had a great rock and roll scene. Like the MC5, I'd never seen that thing.
The reason that we had such a great rock and roll scene is because we didn't really have a scene.
Right.
So, you know, you had people in New York. I mean, there were pockets of activity in New York. There was the Philly sound, the Detroit sound. There was, you know, all these places that everywhere, of course, had its own radio station and its own sound. It was very regional.
Right.
And that all went to the, you know, that was destroyed by, well, MTV came in and it all became very uniform. And then,
satellite killed everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Clear
Channel
programming. The corporate thing. When I went back to Cleveland after I got in my band, and it was now in the 80s, and when I went back and I saw what happened to radio, I was in tears. Because, I grew up with WMMS, and our the disc jockey was a guru who showed us everything. And everything I know about music, I learned from listening to the radio.
What DJ?
Well, it was Billy Bass.
Yeah.
Was the guy there.
These were guys that could make choices about music.
They made...
Had a point of view.
Whatever was going on that day, that's... If it was raining, they play Rainy Day by Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
Whatever it was, you know, Rain by the Beatles. They would just make up the playlist according to... And when I went back and saw that the DJ had no power and that he was given a playlist...
That's horrible.
I was... Anyway, but then it went on to college radio and then it... And, you know, I know I'm older and I'm more old-fashioned that way because I loved radio, but I've never got so good with... The technology. For me, I just turn it on. And when it went to buttons, it started to lose my place.
Yeah, I always just turn on the radio. I don't make a lot of choices, but I usually listen to NPR now. So who were the people that had the most influence on you as a teenager that sort of defined your brain rock-wise?
Oh, well, I mean, I was in the heyday of all the best stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was 14 when the first Beatles album came out. So,
right.
You know, that was just
everyone. So you were like wide open and
totally.
There you go.
Yeah, it was all there. I remember where I was standing when I saw the Jimi Hendrix's album when I was, you know, when I first saw it.
Yeah.
I went to...
Where were you standing?
In someone's house, you know, just in their basement. And they said, look at this.
Was it their brother's or was it theirs? Did they just buy it?
It was someone's, maybe someone. I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, I can remember when I went to Disc Records in the Summit Mall and I was going through the bins and I picked up an album and I thought, Freak Out, what does that mean? And I opened it up and I was like, I took it to Danny Smoot, who was the working behind
Zappa's
the till.
Freak Out?
Yeah, and I said, will you play some of this? And he played Help, I'm a Rock, and it was like this sort of
mind-blowing
beat poetry to this sort of jazz rock.
Yeah.
So I bought that, and then you'd go home and call everyone and say, you've got to hear this.
Zappa's alive.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
So I grew up through, you know, there was, of course, Mitch riding the Detroit Wheels were just up there.
Yeah.
There was Paul Butterfield Blues Band was out there.
Oh, my God.
All the great stuff was coming through Cleveland. Everything came through Cleveland.
Because it was down the street, kind of.
Well, because Cleveland was like a testing ground because
right.
we didn't have our own scene so much. I mm-hmm. mean, there's a few things that came out of Cleveland. Bobby Womack was from Cleveland. There was, you know, a few bands. Ruby and the Romantics. The Outsiders.
Uh-huh.
There was a few things. But because we didn't have our own scene, people were more collectors and listeners.
Right.
Because they weren't out
right.
grooving. They were in the house. You know, they were sitting by the radio
listening.
So you
actually took more in, probably.
I think so. I think we had a better education. And when, you know, when Bowie did his first tour of America, the first stop was Cleveland, Ohio. When Lou Reed, all the bands.
Did you go?
Yeah.
You saw Bowie on his first tour?
Of course. I was standing outside his sound check.
Wait, so what album would that have been?
Hunky Dory was
oh
out.
My God.
And just the Ziggy Stardust had come out now.
So that was like just, full on.
Yeah, it was right at the moment. And
you saw Lou on what album?
Lou, well, I saw the Velvet Underground there. And then when Lou, that's probably one of his first stops when he went solo.
So you knew to go see all these people.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
But those weren't necessarily mainstream acts, were they, at that time? I mean,
mainstream wasn't the term.
Right. So you would go and would it be packed out? Like how big were the rooms when you saw Bowie?
I don't know. They were, you know,
a few hundred?
Like the Agora.
Uh-huh.
They were, you know.
Were they clubs or concerts?
Kind of standing clubs with a, yeah.
God, that must
it wasn't.
Mind-blowing.
There was no mainstream. It didn't exist. It wasn't the word. The term household name didn't exist. If you were a rock fan,
but there was
fan,
still a circuit of like old rockers, right? That did, you know, like hit music.
Well, I mean, the people that were enthusiasts, there might be like 12 in your high school.
Right. Exactly.
It wasn't everyone.
Right.
So you know, yeah. if you went to a place like that, you saw everyone else from Northeastern Ohio who happened to like the Rolling Stones. I saw them with. I've seen every Rolling Stone lineup.
Yeah.
My girlfriends and I were 14 when we went and saw them with Brian Jones.
Really?
Yeah. I was there, man.
I wish I.
That's how I can be the leader of a rock band because I listened to the radio and I saw these guys.
But you saw Brian Jones. I mean, I've never talked to anybody that saw Brian Jones. I don't think. Like, it must have been amazing. I can't even imagine what that was like. And I'm a Stones fan.
Yeah.
The first time I saw them.
It was amazing.
It was like 1981.
No, this was like 66.
Yeah, I know. I missed it by 10 years.
Well, I didn't see everything. I didn't see Hendrix and, you know, I didn't see the Beatles. But, you know, I saw what I could.
So what was the big switch? I mean, when did, because, you know, I know that, you know, music changed drastically and you were sort of, you felt the movement to do something with it. When did that start to happen for yourself?
Oh, well, I would have liked to have done something, you know, when I was listening to Blind Faith and The Cream and, you know, Traffic
but
and all the bands.
But you weren't playing at all?
Yeah, I had a guitar, but, you know, I was a girl and I wasn't good enough to play along to the radio.
Right.
And I wouldn't have gone with the guys in the art room and gone to a jam on the weekend because I just would have been too, you know, I mean, some of my girlfriends played.
Right.
You know, I was still shy around guys.
Right.
And I didn't want to say, hey, look, I learned Born in Chicago. You know, I just couldn't have. But I had my
great
guitar
song.
And, yeah. And I, you know, I had my Johnny Winter albums and I, you know, I loved it. My John Hammond albums, I mean, I loved that.
John Hammond, the older John Hammond records are great.
Amazing.
They're great.
Yeah.
I was just listening to Johnny Winter yesterday. But
fantastic.
Still Alive and Well. I mean, that's the one I was
listening
to. I
had the one where with the black sleeve and his reflection in the black guitar.
Like it was like mirror?
Yeah, with a little
Second Winter
on it and everything.
I
don't know what it was
called.
Yeah,
yeah. God, he could play, man.
Oh, amazing. I actually saw him once backstage somewhere at a festival and I couldn't even walk up and say anything to him.
Yeah, I was supposed to interview him when he
big
and,
fan.
Like a week or two after he passed away. It was pretty sad. It was amazing about him is that how pure blues he went. Like he started with that rockin' and then he just went straight up blues. It's great.
It was a great time. So the music was definitive.
When did you first start to say, like, I'm going to do it?
Well, you know, first I had to leave the States, and then I went and I would have maybe wanted to be a singer. I mean, I tried a little something in Ohio with a couple guys. We did. I was too afraid.
Yeah. Why'd you have to leave the States, did you think?
Well, it was just time for me to go. You know, like that S. Clay Wilson influence didn't work out very well for me.
You hit the wall?
And I needed to get out. And, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do there, but I wanted to you know, see the world. That's what I wanted to do. So
how old were you?
22 when I went to England.
And what was the reason?
I wanted to go somewhere.
And you just moved there?
Yeah.
What did your parents say?
I think they probably didn't know what was happening.
And you just left?
Pretty much, yeah.
Do you have siblings?
I have an older brother. Yeah, he's there.
He's in England?
No, he's in Ohio. He's played in the same band for 45 years, the Numbers Band in Kent, Ohio. He was the musician, Terry Hine. He was this great musician. I was just Terry Hine's little sister, so.
What kind of music did he play?
He's a jazz saxophonist.
Really?
Uh-huh.
And is he great?
Yeah, he's really great. He really is great.
So you grew up with that in the house?
Yeah, but he would say, Christy, you know, in 10 years' time, people won't even know what rock and roll was, because he came from a jazz background.
He thought jazz was going to win?
Well, you know, maybe it should have, you know.
Maybe.
As a musical form, it should have. I mean, it's definitely got dumbed down. You know, there's no question about it.
Yeah.
Especially as it's going now. But I mean, there's no bands anymore. That's kind of over. It's a dying breed. But at the time, you know, in the mid-60s is when jazz was in its heyday. I saw Mose Allison just stop touring.
Oh, really?
Huge influence, another one. Anyway, I took off. And I then, it was around the time that punk started to happen that at that point, by the time I was 24, I thought I was too old to get in a band. You know, back in those days, 24 was, you were already, you know.
Yeah.
People were in bands when they were 15 and 16,
right.
And they went out and played. And that's why the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, and those guys, they all could make albums in 3 days, their first albums, because they'd been playing it for years.
Right, right.
And they could play.
Yeah,
you know, it's the opposite of how people make records today. They can't play, and it takes them 2 years.
Right. And there's no one in the room with them when they're playing.
Yeah, and they've never played in front of anyone.
Right.
So they get a huge hit, and they've never been on stage.
But
so,
those,
you know, it's...
Those guys who played their dues, they had that one mind thing, right? And they understood
each
other.
Yeah, they played. They could play. And every band... I mean, every town in the States had a bar band, a local bar band, which is what Bruce Springsteen was. He was like the local bar band that European kids never had.
In Asbury Park.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We all had one. In my town, we had a band called the Brambles. I mean, everyone had a band that everyone went to see in the 60s.
Did you? Was Iggy around when you were in?
Iggy was, but I got introduced to Iggy when I became interested in David Bowie, because to me, Iggy and the Stooges would have still been a little bit like a local thing, and I was thought I wanted English music. So
right.
When I saw that Bowie was listening to him, then I globbed on. Then I went up to see, well, Bowie played in Cleveland, then we drove to Detroit to see him, and this is on his first tour, and you know, I would never leave the place when everyone was like, come on, Chris, we have to drive 100 miles, let's go, and I couldn't take my eyes off the stage, even after the crew was breaking down the gear and the lights were up.
Yeah.
And there he was, Iggy Pop. He walked by me.
Yeah. Did you say anything?
Of course not. But, I mean, he looked at me and I looked at him. And, you know, that's it. I couldn't talk for the next 3 hours. I was sort of stricken.
Astounding performer, that guy.
Yeah. I mean, he was just walking by.
Even then, that was great.
Oh, I mean, I was just so... And that changed everything for me. And I thought that, in England they would understand Iggy more because I read an article of someone that, anyway, it's a long story. So, it's a long story and it's probably boring, but
no, it's not boring.
I got there in the end.
Good for a long story.
I got there in the end.
But so you were hung up on the British rock.
Yeah, but I liked the Buffalo, Springfield, and Crosby, Stills.
I get it.
And, you know,
but
you thought
your future was in England somehow.
Well, I knew that I just had to go.
Yeah. So when did you get there? What year was it?
1973.
So what was going on?
What were you doing? Well, I had to walk up. I said, I was with a friend, and I said, take us to a hotel. So they took us somewhere in London, near the Bayswater Road. I didn't know anything about London, so we went to some kind of a hotel or hostel. And then I walked up to the top of the road where there's these sort of like a street market. I'd never seen anything like that. And I just went to every stall and asked if anyone could give me a job. Because, you know, I was going to have to work. I only had a couple hundred dollars.
Right.
And then someone agreed to give me a job. And, you know, it just went on from there, selling handbags. And then I met, you know, it just went on from there. And within about 5 years, I'd done some traveling around. I went back over to Paris and then back to Cleveland by the time I wanted to get into a band.
Were you seeing then, though, like in 73? I mean,
That was a bad time for music. I mean, of course, the New York Dolls were about to emerge. Todd Rundgren had been doing some really great stuff. I'd seen him before I went over when he was with those Sales Brothers. And he had a guy named Yves Labatt or Jean Labatt, Jean something.
I interviewed Hunt in Tucson.
Right. Well, the Hunt brothers were there. And when I got over to London, it wasn't, you know, I was thinking that Mark Bolan would be playing down the street. But, you know, it was kind of the end of that. I'd seen him. I driven up to Toronto with a friend and he was playing when I was still in Ohio.
You saw T-Rex?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So you were like a full-on fan.
Totally.
That was
Are you kidding?
That was your life.
Of course. Big time. That was it.
You just loved rock.
Totally. That's what it was.
And so when you went to England, it was more to sort of get your head together than anything else.
Kind of, and to start to see the world and, you know, see what I was going to do. And
Did you study or did you go to school or anything?
No. I'd gone to Kent State for a little while to buy some time.
Right.
But, you know,
yeah.
I started there when I was 17, and it was that summer, the first Neil Young album was out and the first Tim Buckley out, or not the first Tim Buckley, Happy Sad had just come out. So that's what I did that summer, was listen to those two records.
That was it. That was it.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't doing real good in school. And then, there was a course and I went to Mexico. That was the one time I'd been there with my school course. I kind of flunked that too, but
You saw Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there was the shootings at Kent State and then they closed down the school and all that.
Oh, so you were there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Just having seen this documentary last night about the MC5 in 67, 68, 69, 70. I mean, I can't even imagine, because I didn't live it, the amount of weird chaos and unpredictability that was just everywhere. So the music sort of reflected all that.
Yeah, well, it was certainly an interesting time with, you know, Vietnam. Everyone was taking a lot of drugs, of which we're still limping away from that. You know, that was a tragedy in the end, because it started out as mind-expanding pot,
right,
and that sort of thing. But then, of course, you got the criminal element in there because it was illegal.
The bikers.
So you had to buy it from,
yeah,
you know, people that were selling you anything they could.
Right.
And then the drugs got, and you know, people get addicted and they started buying.
Speed and heroin.
Yeah.
Killed a lot of people.
Sure did.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
I mean, alcohol was not the drug of choice, but as we know, that's probably the most insidious because it's been legal, and that's the one that's killed most people.
Yeah.
And usually when there's, you know, some sort of weird cocktail, it's alcohol related.
Yeah,
is what I.
It's persistent. Keeps going. Keeps giving.
It takes a licking, but it still keeps ticking.
That's right. So what was the first sort of forays into, standing up with your guitar and getting involved? How did you transition from selling handbags in
England? Well, I had a bunch of different jobs, and then that punk thing was happening. You know, I went over to someone's house to get a cat from this woman, a kitten.
Yeah.
And I walked in, and I think she was a pot dealer. And I heard this little band, and I said, "What's going on there?" And she goes, "That's my son's band." And I walked in the next room, and it was just in a little flat, and I said, they were 14-year-old kids, and I thought, I thought they were amazing. And I said, they were playing sort of kind of heavy metal type thing. And I said, "Well, why don't you guys play Velvet Underground if you can only play three chords?" And they went, "Well, what's that?" And I said, "Well, here." I took the guitar and showed this kid how to play White Light, White Heat.
Right.
And I could see them looking at me like, how come mom's friend knows how to do that? And that didn't occur to me. I thought, oh, yeah, I can play.
Right.
Because I'd been doing that, you know, in Ohio, obviously. And I thought, wow, I thought, I wonder if I could manage these. I mean, I've got no business, nothing to do. I've never, I'm the most hands-off with business person I've ever met in this business.
Right.
But I thought I was too old to be in a band. I thought, well, maybe I can guide them somehow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I was maybe 23, 24 at the time.
And did you?
No. But I kind of got the taste for the guitar again.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, and then around then I started, it was just before punk, and then I started meeting a lot of people, and everyone was at it trying to get a band together. And that's when I kind of got in there, and being a girl wasn't kind of a novelty then. It was very non-discriminatory, the punk thing. So anyone could do anything. You didn't even have to play.
Right.
I mean, you didn't have to be able to play. In fact, it was kind of a disadvantage. So, you know, everything was going in my favor.
And you, so you saw the that scene sort of taking form.
Totally. I was there. I knew, played with everyone in that scene, and I knew everyone
who
in the
who were those
scene.
Kids? Did they end up
well,
anywhere?
I mean, I was working for Vivian Westwood and Malcolm McLaren in their shop for a little while. I knew all
where
the guys.
Where was that, on like Kings Road or
the
somewhere?
The Kings Road, yeah.
Yeah.
I knew all the guys that were gotten to the Sex Pistols, the Damned. I was going to do a band with them. Some of the guys in the Clash I started working with before they became the Clash. I knew all of them. I was in there trying to get a band together.
How'd you meet them all? Just from working at the store? Or just
from being in London, yeah. I just met everyone that, yeah.
And what was McLaren like?
He was a... I loved him. I thought he was... I really looked up to him, actually. I thought he was really a unique... He wasn't a hippie. That was the thing about Malcolm and Vivian. They weren't hippies. They weren't coming from that... They were more coming from a sort of teddy boy, student intellectual kind of thing and very English. So it was kind of new to me. So I found it fascinating and I looked up to them because they had this whole other way of, you know, this look was different and than anything I'd seen. And I they loved like the New York Dolls. Malcolm was going to do something with them. And we talked about doing something together and he tried to help me too. But
so in looking at it, do you think that when the New York Dolls sort of happened, because I mean, I read the Legs McNeil book, and he sort of thinks that they were the beginning of what became American punk anyways. But do you think that what Malcolm was seeing was interpreting this fashion? I mean, did it start with fashion?
Well, I would say more of an anti-fashion.
Right.
It didn't seem like it at the time.
Look.
Well, they defined the look, Malcolm and Vivian. Certainly.
They designed all that stuff.
They designed it all.
And that became the standard.
Well, people copied it. The idea was to do your own thing.
Right.
But, you know, it was such a great look and everyone, you know, so they just certainly, you know, people are natural born followers. If you see a band and it looks great, you want to look like that.
And it was completely anti-establishment.
Well, yeah, it was.
That was the idea of it. Even more so, like, because then they had to make it different than the 60s anti-establishment.
Yeah, it was very, very different.
It was almost anti-60s anti-establishment.
Sure it was.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember standing in a club called The Vortex just after the Roxy closed, and Elvis Presley died, and they were cheering. I mean, I thought that was out of order. But that was the tone of things at the time, was like, you know, the king is dead. They wanted it all to go.
Right.
I mean, this was 6 months after punk had, you know, punk only lasted about 6 months. So this was toward the end of it.
When it only lasted 6 months in earnest, you think?
Yeah.
What were those 6 months and who were the prime movers in that?
Well, the Sex Pistols, the Clash then came along after the Sex Pistols. The Damned came along then after that. There was the Adverts. Then the Slits came along. There was, I mean, this is just in London. Of course, there was all over the UK. There was the Buzzcocks were happening. There was the Undertones. There was all that two-tone stuff going on from like Coventry, Bristol.
The ska stuff?
All the ska stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, UB40 was a little reggae band who I saw in a basement somewhere and said, hey, come and... You know, by then, around that time, I'd got my band together. So this was over a period of 3 years. But the punk thing didn't last very long, no.
Yeah. Did you see the Sex Pistols?
Oh, yeah.
A lot?
Of course.
Was it a mess?
It was always, you never knew what was going to happen.
But you come from you had a tremendous respect for people that played and that, you know, made amazing music. You grew up with
that.
Yeah,
but now it had got a bit flabby and it was getting a little bit prog rockish.
So when
the Sex Pistols came along, it was a very, up yours to all that, and it was really deconstructing everything and bringing it back to basics. And in England, it's very tribal too. And I like that knowing the playing, it was more attitude than playing because the playing had become too important,
right,
in music.
But a lot of those people that you mentioned could really play. I mean, you know, the Clash could play.
Well, yeah, they were pretty basic.
Yeah, well, yeah.
As soon as you really got serious about playing, it started not being so punky anymore.
Was that what killed punk? Was it people?
Pretty much.
Yeah. People said, like, well, we got the look, let's play.
Yeah, and
for
also
real.
If no one could really play and there wasn't, that was frustrating too, because people, you know, guitar players wanted to learn their craft and to get better. So
and was the end of punk sort of around like
probably about 78?
Because your band, you know, that's very
my band wasn't a punk band because
it's very articulated.
Jimmy Scott, last of the great guitar heroes, if you ask me, James Honeyman Scott, he didn't really like punk. He was in Hereford, which was out in the sticks. And, you know, to him, it was kind of angry and it wasn't musical. He liked ABBA and the Beach Boys, which you couldn't say at the time. But he was only, you know, he was 23. And that's what he liked. So, you know, and he came into it.
And how'd you meet him?
Through Pete Farndon, who was also from Hereford.
The bass
Lemmy
player.
Told me to see, look up this guy who was, I was looking for a band. It's a long story, man. You know, Lemmy did? Yeah, Lemmy was another.
That was the whole other side that you didn't even mention was that metal side of.
Oh, punk. Lemmy was very instrumental in my history. Without him, the Pretenders wouldn't have happened.
How'd you meet him, and how does that unfold?
Because he hung out with all the bikers and stuff in London. So of course, you know, I gravitated.
That was your thing.
It seems to have been. and when I got there, that's who I met. And then, you know, and they were all, you know. In fact, Lemmy, the first time I met him, I was in a shop on the King's Road, and he walked up to me and he stuck he didn't say anything. He just stuck this silver tube he had around his neck on a chain in a bag of white powder and, you know, shoved it up my snout and walked away. I was up for 3 days.
that was the first meeting?
Yeah. We didn't talk. But Lemmy was always around, and Lemmy was coming. Hawkwind was shutting down, and he was about to start Motorhead, and Motorhead had its own thing. You know, there was also T-Rex, and some of those bands had been pre-glam, were sort of still into this kind of hippie, you know. So there was in that Notting Hill area, there was a lot of Rastafarians too. They influenced the punk thing a lot. In fact, in London, the only music that the punks listened to was reggae music. I never heard anything else in anyone's house. No one listened. In the Roxy Club, all they listened to was reggae music.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a big influence, and it had an influence on the music. But Hawkwind and, well, Motorhead now, they kind of lived outside of it all because, you know, it was Lemmy.
Right.
And Lemmy's always Lemmy.
Yeah. Did you like Hawkwind?
Well, it was a little before my time. I probably arrived. There was the Hawkwind and the Pink Fairies and those bands.
Right.
The first band I saw when I got to London was Kilburn and the High Road. Kilburn and the High Roads at the 100 Club. And that was then became, well, that was Ian Dury's band.
Okay. So Lemmy is, how did he introduce you to?
Well, he told me to, I went over and, you know, I was talking to him and he said to keep my eye out for a guy that he thought could be a drummer for me. And, you know, I was kind of feeling sorry for myself because nothing was happening. I'd been trying to get a band together for a long time. And he said, well, no one said it was going to be easy. And I was really shocked that I thought he was going to be a little more simpatico.
So he was a guy, his crewer who you would hang out with. He was sort of like a big brother, buddy kind of thing.
Yeah, he wanted to fuck me, you know. Yeah. But
you didn't relent?
Well, you know, this isn't a kiss and tell. So, but I... So you know, I went over and I said, look, man, you know, nothing's happening.
Yeah.
And he said, well, check this guy out named Gas. So then I saw this guy in the street one
Gas?
Saturday. Gas Wild, his name was.
Yeah.
So I saw the guy that Lemmy described on the street and I opened the window. I said, is your name Gas? And he went, yeah. I said, you want to get in a band? He went, yeah, but I don't have any drums. I said, I'll sort that out. So I brought him into it. And then through this guy, Gas, he was from Hereford.
Yeah.
And through him, I met Pete Farndon, who was from Hereford. Pete Farndon was my bass player then.
The original
bass player,
yeah.
And through him, we got James Honeyman Scott, and then we found Martin. So they were all from Hereford.
Right. So they were completely outside of punk.
They were completely outside of punk.
What were they coming from?
Pete was very enamored with punk.
Right.
But he was more enamored with the Heartbreakers when they came to town. And when they came to town about heroin, it was the end of punk.
Right.
And Pete got into all that.
So Johnny Thunders changed it.
Yeah. He did.
Yeah. And that was sort of what became known as American punk, was that trip.
Well, they weren't considered punk. They were musically, they were the first band that came to the Roxy Club where they could actually play and everyone was blown away and just loved them because they were even more fucked up than the punks.
Right.
But they could play. So, I mean, you know, people really were very respectful of the Heartbreakers.
Great tone.
They were amazing.
Oh, man.
And I mean, of course, I mean, I saw the New York Dolls with Malcolm and Vivian, actually, when they came over.
Yeah.
And then the first gig I had as the Pretenders, I was invited by David Johansen to play with his band, the David Johansen Band, up at Barbarella's in Birmingham.
And so, what was Jimmy Scott then? What was his... How did you guys sort of meld minds around what you were going to do, your tone?
Well, I needed to get to put some demos together, and I got... Actually, I wanted... there was rumors that Motorhead might break up, and... I knew that someone said that the Heartbreakers kind of had their eye on Filthy Animal Taylor, who was their, you know, kid drummer.
Yeah.
And I wanted Phil in my band because I had this idea that my band would be like a motorcycle club, but with guitars. You know, I mean, I thought I was a badass. Yeah. So, you know, and I didn't want anyone else sniffing around Phil in case they did break up. But of course, I couldn't approach him because he was in motor. I wouldn't have dreamt of doing such a thing. But I thought, well, what if we say that we're auditioning for a guitar player and we ask Phil to help us and then he'll see what we have to offer.
Uh-huh.
And then if they do break up, he would have, you know, we'd be able to put a bid in for him.
Remember us? Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, they didn't break up. But we got, we had to get a guitar player in to do this faux audition.
Right.
So Pete said, well, I know a couple guys in Hereford. And I said, okay. And he goes, well, there's a local guitar hero and then this little brother of this girl I used to go out with. And I said, well, you know, get the guy in the place, you know, whichever. So he started calling. I said, hang on a minute. The local guitar hero, he's married and has a kid, doesn't he? And he went, yeah. And I said, put the phone down. I said, call the other kid.
Yeah.
So he called the kid and that was Jimmy Scott. So he came to town, and I don't think we liked each other much. He saw me. I was too angry.
Right.
But we ended up eventually making these demos we needed to make together. And as soon as I listened to the demos, I knew that I'd found my guitar player.
Yeah, he's astounding.
So I had to figure out how to get him to leave his girlfriend and his job and to leave Hereford. But he didn't like punk, but he loved Nick Lowe.
Right.
And so I knew Nick Lowe. So I thought, that's it. I'll just get Nick Lowe to say that he'll produce our first single, and then Jimmy will have to join us.
Right.
So I left the stuff over with Nick.
Yeah.
And it was all songs I had written except for this one cover from an old Kinks album that I remembered. And then, of course, Nick wasn't into my songs so much because they were too angry, but he loved what he called the Sandy Shaw song. So I said, we'll do it. So I called Jimmy Scott. I said, Nick Lowe's going to produce us. But because I knew that would seduce Jimmy.
Right.
But before I even got a chance to ask him, he goes, wait, before you say anything, I've been listening to the demos, and can I be in the band?
So he was already in.
So he was already in. And then Nick did the first Pretender single, which was Stop Your Sobbing.
And that was huge.
It was pretty big, I think. I think it was in the top 20 or something.
So that was really the evolution out of punk was Nick Lowe was kind of elemental in helping your sound.
Yes, big time. Nick Lowe had a lot to do with my, you know, without Nick, I would have stumbled along. I wanted him to do my album.
Yeah.
He was busy. But by then, of course, I knew Chris Thomas, who I'd met through Chris Spedding, who I'd met in Paris when I was doing something. And I took Chris Spedding to go see the Sex Pistols because he wanted to get in on something. And, you know, Spedding ended up producing their demos. And I'd sung on some of Spedding's solo albums. And that's where I met Chris Thomas, who then went on to produced the Sex Pistols' first record, and he did the Pretenders. We considered him the fifth Pretender for the first three albums.
It's a completely different game than the Sex Pistols, too, right? I mean, you guys were totally, you know.
Yeah, well, we were musical.
Yeah.
That was Jimmy Scott, see? And then I didn't realize that I had this, I was kind of in denial of my musicality because, you know, I thought, you know, it was all about not really heavy metal, but, you know, I was more deconstructed and angry. And that melodic thing, I kind of had forgot about that. But, you know, I mean, I grew up listening to James Brown, you know. I was listening to real melodic stuff.
But you have a beautiful melodic voice. And you were in denial about it?
Or? I didn't know what it was yet because I hadn't really sung yet. So, but
the first Pretenders album feels like your voice is fully realized.
Well, who knows? I don't know where that came from. And I mean, I had only been in one band back in Ohio, and that was with a guy I met in Cauga Falls. And he put a little band together called Sat Sun Matt. We did one show in a church hall of covers, and I was petrified. Anyway, I met him years later. Him and his band Devo came to town, and I said, hey, man, what was that band? Remember the band we were in? What did it mean? And he went, Saturday, Sunday, Matinee. And that was Mark Mothersbaugh. That's who I had my first band with.
Really?
Yeah. And I was about 16.
And that's the other unmentioned Ohio band, isn't it?
There were a few.
And they were a whole other thing. I mean, outside of punk and outside of whatever happened at the end of the 60s and outside of pop, Devo took, you know, this art rock idea and just elevated it to a level.
They were the acceptable face of quirky.
Yeah.
And I don't like wacky stuff much, you know, but
not a big Residents fan or anything like that.
I wasn't that. I mean, I like the Ramones. I wasn't that keyed on the New York scene. It was a bit arty for me. I wouldn't have put it in those terms at the time.
Even in retrospect, you're not?
Well, in retrospect, things are always different. You know,
right.
We rewrite history, and bands that didn't seem very important at the time suddenly become...
But I would think you'd like television.
I probably didn't listen to much of that. Remember, we were only listening to reggae music. When I first heard reggae music, it stopped me in my tracks, and I thought, this is the future.
Right.
I thought I'd seen the future, and I was shocked that it never took off in America. I thought everything would change with reggae. But it influenced that punk thing. And then when it came into... Then disco came, and that fucked everything up.
Fucked everything up bad.
But when...
That was like such a left turn. Like, why were we
in
that? That's when I went to high school, is like... Punk had sort of not really took traction in the States, you know, in the late 70s. And it was just fucking disco everywhere. And then all of a sudden the Knack happened. And that was the end of it.
Well, yeah. you know, because reggae had a sort of a spiritual base.
Sure.
And I think, you know, black American music started getting a real smash and grab mentality.
Right.
And they didn't want the spiritual stuff so much. You know, it's a weird one, the way that all... I mean, it still never really took off, reggae, but it certainly influenced house music.
Yeah.
In England was always very, very heavily influenced by
reggae.
I mean, James Brown was the guy that influenced everything.
Yeah.
Even reggae he influenced. He was the man.
So, all right, so the first album happens and you're on the map in a big way. I mean, like I remember everybody, you were huge. Did you feel it? Did you like?
Not really. No, I've never felt. I always feel the same. I don't feel. First of all, I said to my manager, "Never call me with chart positions," and I never really wanted to look at that or read reviews or read anything. That's always been my policy. Nothing to do with business. Nothing to do with. I never had A&R. You know, I just did my thing.
But you knew getting on stage that the crowds were getting bigger.
You know, I was getting over my stage fright and being self-conscious. I didn't want to be self-conscious, so I try not to. I just tried to do what I had to do.
And like so the first three albums all had hits on them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we weren't catering to anything.
No,
it just
happened
to work that way.
Yeah,
I mean, eventually we weren't having hits, and I did try to cater. But, you know, that was a long time.
What album did that start on?
Well, that's when I did I'll Stand By You with Billy and Tom.
Yeah.
Tom Kelly and Billy Steinberg.
Yeah.
And that was when I said, well, hang on a minute. I'm not on the radio anymore, you know, and I didn't like it.
Yeah.
Because I'm about radio.
Right.
That was always about, that's why I was okay to have my first single be that Kinks cover, and all my punk friends were like, what are you doing? What happened to your songs? And I was like, yeah, but this is a better single.
Right.
You know, I had a radio mentality.
Right. You wanted to stay relevant.
And I wanted Nick Lowe to produce it.
And then, like, at what point did all the did Jimmy Scott pass away? And
Well, Jimmy, we fired Pete in the beginning of 1984. Because he got too smacked out.
Yeah.
And that was the worst time, obviously, because we had to tell him. And anyway, and then Jimmy was dead 3 days later
from a
drug overdose.
And that was in 83? And you'd already recorded Learning to Crawl?
No, Learning to Crawl was a reference to that.
To getting
out
of that.
To starting over. And I was pregnant and I had a little kid now. So I had to,
You say that like it was like, now I got this.
Well, you know, I'd never even held a baby, and I had to deal with all this stuff and keep my band alive, and they just died on me, you know. Pete and Jimmy. Then Pete died 8 months later, and the last time I saw him was at Jimmy's funeral. He wasn't happy. Obviously, we had to find, it was all fucked up. That's what happens with drugs.
Yeah.
It was all fucked up.
But it wasn't necessarily surprising.
Well, it's never surprising when someone dies, you know.
But you knew there were drugs everywhere.
You know that's always a...
Yeah, yeah. And you just have to deal with it. You just have to live with the fact. Because, I mean, everyone was... You know when you have a band member who's using drugs, there's nothing you can really do, right?
Yeah, we were all using drugs.
Right.
You know, you
can't
really...
And that was the risk.
That's the deal.
And when you had the baby, was this a surprise baby?
No.
Okay.
No. I was, you know, at that point, I was...
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I wanted this... I thought I was going to get married and everything, but anyway.
To Ray.
Yeah.
And is that, how is that kid?
Good, thank you.
Good. And so now you got a baby, you got
and then Jimmy died, and then after we just fired Pete, and it wasn't. and the best of times.
And the but the next album you pulled out, you transcended. I mean, that was a good record.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
And now I guess learning to call. Yeah, yeah. We, you know, what can you do? You have to keep living. So.
And how do you like now that you're like after you've gone through this period, and I've talked to musicians that have had, you know, where you have this amazing momentum and then, you know, this music changes in a way or what?
Well, domesticity kind of, you know, kills it off. That doesn't help.
On your side.
Well, on anyone's side.
Right. But I mean,
and
just
me
what
being
people...
a mother and having to be, you know, like a sort of single parent and stuff, you know, obviously that's your, if anything, it's given me a longevity, or that's how I like to think of it. Because I didn't, you know, burn myself out too fast and just relentlessly keep making records because I had to really take my time.
But you eventually did, you know, get married and like, did you see that settling down?
That never happened.
It didn't happen?
No,
you never
it
got married.
Never worked.
Oh,
I,
never
well,
worked.
I did have a few failed attempts.
Yeah.
But I kept the music going. Some,
yeah. They were always putting out records.
Other.
So now how old are your kids? They're older
they're
now.
They're like around 30 each of them. No.
So now you come up with this, the Stockholm record I just listened to yesterday, and it's great.
Thank you.
And you're back in performing mode. And
yeah.
I don't guess you ever left really though.
Not so much. I've pretty much been out on the road doing a lot of touring and, you know, a lot of, I've stayed on it pretty much.
How's this record different? I mean, it is a solo record, which is different.
Well, it's called a solo record, but it's not that different than anything I've done, to be honest. I just happened to meet someone and lived in Stockholm, so I kept going over there, and then I worked with some guys over there. Most of it's done with Björn Yitling and a couple of songs. I just got into this collaboration mode where writing with someone that I didn't know became really fun. I tried it with Tom Kelly and Billy Steinberg, and it was great. I mean, even when I met Bob Dylan years ago, he said, you know, I got some tunes. And, you know, I was like, well, I don't know how to write with someone. I didn't know what to say to him, you know. I didn't know. I wouldn't have known how to sit down and write with someone else.
He wanted to collaborate?
Well, I think he was, you know, inviting that.
Uh-huh. Where'd you meet him?
Backstage at a... Bill Graham set it up. Bill Graham called and said, do you want to see... come back and, you know, so you want to see this Dylan show?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, yeah.
What year was that?
83, 84.
So you knew Bill, like, because we mentioned...
Yeah, I knew
you,
Bill.
Yeah, he was a...
We had conversations saying, hey, you know, we should get a whole bunch of bands like they used to do with those soul reviews and take them right across the States. And I'd have conversations like that with him. Yeah, anyway, so... But I didn't really know how to collaborate, and I...
You wrote all your own songs by yourself.
At first, yeah, just with a guitar. I mean, they weren't very good, but when I brought them to Jimmy Scott and the band, they transformed them into something that sounded great.
That's collaborating.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as the initial writing of the song, I...
Like actually playing with hooks or playing with phrasing. And,
yeah, well,
and,
they added all that, but, you know, I had to come up with the
lyric.
The thing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the song, and say, here's the song, and then they would make it interesting.
And how are you collaborating now that's
well, now
different?
I can just go in and say, what do you got? You know, and the guy might say, well, I mean, he might whistle something into a phone and I'll say, all right, leave it with me for a half an hour.
And you'd work it out vocally?
Yeah.
Because
you know, there's all sorts of ways you could do it. But I mean, I found it's more fun than sitting alone and doing it.
Sure.
And, you know, and it's just, it's kind of isolating sometimes. I mean, it's very rewarding writing songs. And I suppose it's the thing I like the most. But, anyway, so I went to Stockholm with Bjorn.
Yeah.
But he could only work for 2 or 3 days at a time because he was busy. So I kept going back and forth. And then Jocke Ohlund, who is another guy I met there, I wrote a couple tunes with him. Adding the Blue is one of them. And now I just think, oh, and they wouldn't, I said, come on, you guys, let's get in a band and like take this on the road.
Yeah.
And I was going to call us the Russian Icons. Uh-huh. And then they wouldn't leave their wives and their bands and their studios.
Huh.
To be with me. So I guess I'm losing my touch.
I could get them to leave their life.
So I had to, you know, go back to London, and that was why it's got just my name on it.
Right. So you spent a lot of time in Stockholm. Had you been there before?
Well, yeah, to play, but I hadn't really, you know, I only went there to
Is it amazing? Is it relaxing?
It's gorgeous. It's
beautiful.
It's amazing. But I mean, I was in a hotel in the studio, and then, you know, airport, gate, studio, train.
Right.
You know, I spent a lot of time on my own.
Right. With
probably too much to be healthy, but that's another story. That's what I ended up with, that Stockholm. And it's a kind of, I suppose you could say, a way of rebooting my brand. And let's face it, that's what it is these days. You know, you have to keep your thing alive. And, I mean, for example, I did a show at a festival called the Latitude Festival in London, outside of London, actually, a few months ago. And I was on the same bill as the Black Keys and Chaim. Mm-hmm. And Tame Impala. Now, if I'd gone out as the Pretenders, I probably wouldn't have got on that bill. They probably would have thought it was too old of a band.
Right.
But, you know, because it was just me, I kind of snuck in there and it was something different. So, you know, in a way, that's why I say it's given me some longevity, because I haven't really done that much when you think about it. I haven't done as much as, like, Elvis Costello's probably made 40 albums.
I think he's probably putting out one every few months.
Yeah, but see, I don't. Yeah. I haven't had the time. And also, I goof off a lot more than he does.
Well, how were you received on that bill? Did you feel when
good.
You performed?
Pretty yeah, good. I mean, the audience wasn't really there. I was on probably around 1 p.m. It was maybe an older audience. And then Tame Impala, then more kids came in, and then Chaim and, notice how I pronounce it the proper way, girls, my Valley girl friends.
Chaim.
They're the little Valley girls here from L.A.
They're great?
Yeah, they're great. And the reason they're great is because they've been on the road. They took their shit on the road for the last 2 years, so they're really playing. They're
yeah.
sisters.
Right.
They're these, you know, little girls from the Valley that are, you know, and their dad's Israeli. They're awesome because they're playing. That's
right.
It. When a band goes on the road and plays, they get good.
Get tight.
And, I mean, and then the Black Keys, what a success story they are, you
yeah.
know, because they've been out doing the same thing. That doesn't happen very much where people work their way up because they get out and they keep playing. But anyway, on this Latitude Festival, I mean, I was with an incarnation of this band, the Will Travel Band, and I...
Who are those guys?
Well, I've now got James Wolborn, who was the guy who I've been playing with in the Pretenders for a few years.
Uh-huh.
And some other guys, a Danish drummer. Chris Sohn, none of the guys that played on that album. See, I had to put a band together
right.
to showcase the Stockholm album. I really wasn't sure how I was going to do that.
So what do? You rehearse for how long to get tight?
A couple weeks.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we showcased that album. And then from there, I didn't know what I was going to do because I didn't really have... I wasn't sure what I was going to do. But it evolved where I got offered a few things. So I thought, well... I guess if I can do some of my old tunes, even though they're Pretenders, because they're my songs, why not?
Why wouldn't you?
Well, yeah. So I did that. And then I got some more offers. Oh, if you're going to do some old stuff, then you can have another gig. So,
sure.
So,
and you know, there's no, I mean, you feel good playing those songs?
Which ones?
Your Pretender songs?
Yeah, as long as the audience is new, of course.
They love it, don't they? They love it.
If anyone is, you know, that's how people can, I suppose, go on stage in a play for 2 years and do the same play every night, because every night's a new audience,
well,
it's new. It's
look
new
at the
again.
Rolling Stones.
Well, yeah. I'm not, you know.
Yeah.
I'm there.
I always wonder, because even somebody like you who has integrity and you have you know, a sensibility around, you know, what music is that there's
well,
no...
Well, you don't know that for sure.
I kind of do. Well, I'm not. Maybe I'm projecting. But... What I'm saying is that there's no shame in playing great songs that are your
songs.
Well,
no, who's ashamed? You
yeah.
know?
Yeah. I
was
wondering.
Playing them already.
Yeah.
That's it. But obviously, if you're doing, I mean, like I said, this is an art form that's pretty dumbed down. I mean, you know,
right.
you see some people on documentaries and they're playing their tunes to a big audience and think, that's, come on, man. It's not even that good.
Yeah.
That happens all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's just like mega huge. And like a
sometimes
lot of.
Sometimes they're not even really playing.
Well, you know, or you wish they weren't.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then a lot of these now, because it's all been plundered so much, you see documentaries on the greats, and they
right.
do rewrite their own history
sure.
where they were the biggest, most important band. And a lot of this was just M.O.R. stuff, you know.
What's
I mean,
that?
I wish Karen Carpenter was around, because she was considered, the Carpenters were considered very saccharine M.O.R. They weren't taken very
What's
seriously.
M.O.R.?
Middle of the road,
oh, okay, got
AOR.
It.
I don't
yeah,
know what you
no,
call
it's
it.
Fine. Middle of the road's good.
Yeah,
I just didn't know it's
not
different.
Very
yeah.
cutting edge.
Right,
not really
sure,
rock.
Sure.
And
you wish she was alive for what? To
yeah,
defend?
To get her due, because she was one of the greatest singers who ever lived. You
yeah,
know? And people
yeah.
didn't. Of course, she was taken seriously because they sold a lot of records.
Right.
And people loved them.
But they were categorized.
They were categorized as being.
Yeah.
you know, very much like the Beach Boys. We thought that they were too squeaky clean.
Right.
Little did we know that they were not very squeaky clean at all.
Right.
And you know, but the music was very all-American.
Right. Oh, yeah. I can't. It's hard for me to listen to some Beach Boys because I can't handle how heavy Brian's heart is sometimes.
Right. But at the time when they came out, you know, it was all, I wish they all could be Count, but we were like, what the fuck? You know, because we were taking, you know, we didn't.
Yeah. Where's the edge?
We thought that was nice.
Yeah.
But in fact, it wasn't very nice.
No,
as we
not
can,
at all.
We know that now.
It's a little brutal.
So when you get a bit of hindsight, dare I say, and you can look over, you know, with a bit of perspective, you see these things in a different light. ABBA, great band, great tunes.
Yeah.
Not taken seriously at the time because it was a little too nice.
Right.
But you can't deny a great melody.
No.
And you can't deny a good song.
No. I was just listening to, what's his name, Tim Hardin, the folks.
Oh, amazing.
I can't even fucking deal. I bought this record out of
because
nowhere.
Because he was a Vietnam vet. He was a junkie.
I bought a record that just on the cover, and I didn't know anything about Tim Hardin. I knew he, now I know he wrote some great songs, but I just bought this record on a fluke, and I'm like, what is this? And I went down a Tim Hardin rabbit hole just last night. And to watch him perform at Woodstock, he is on the nod heavy.
But he had one of the, see, the thing is they could sing.
Yeah.
He had one of the greatest voices ever, Tim Hardin.
Yeah.
And he wrote those beautiful songs. But like the singing thing has changed a lot. It's all changed. Because back then, guys who were 25 years old, they wanted to sound like men.
Right.
I mean, look at Otis, how authoritative he was.
Yeah.
He was gone by the time he was 27. And he had this, all of his music, you felt this manly authority.
Yeah.
You know, now these guys are like, you know, 40 and they're still like little.
How do you get behind it?
So,
you're doing what you do, and did you ever think to, because the one thing that I asked myself when I listened to it was, you know, on the slower numbers where the melodies are you know, kind of very deliberate and slower sort of grooves to them, they're very powerful. Did you ever think to do like an entire record of slower songs or not ballads, but just something?
Yeah, I got two girls in Akron that would probably come and like lynch me if I did that. You know, I have been warned for years to stay clear of the ballads, you know.
Keep rocking.
Yeah. I mean, the girls that put the Pretenders archives together, you know.
So you got to answer to them. At the end of the day.
They keep a low profile. Uh-huh. They kept my thing alive for years. Yeah. But before we had websites or any of that, they were the first ones on it. But if I start getting a little too ballad heavy, then I hear from them.
But you thought about it.
No, I haven't thought about it.
Okay.
Because, you know, no one wants to hear that shit.
All right.
This is supposed to be a rock band. You sneak them in once in a while when you can get away with it.
All right. Well, it was great talking to you and have fun on the tour.
That's the plan.
You feel good? You all right?
Sure.
All right. Thanks for talking, Chrissy. How cool was that? She's amazing. I was so happy to talk to her. All right, go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. You can get the app, you know, an upgrade like I told you about at the beginning. I will be at Largo on January 8th. You can go to Largo-LA.com for tickets. Oh, my God. Not even a day off nicotine. I'm losing my fucking mind. I don't even know if I can play guitar. I know you've all been waiting for that. Huh. I just moved a bunch of knobs. That was crazy. Notice how clean I'm keeping it? No distortion. You know why? Because I'm not ashamed. I don't need to distort shit. I'm so not ashamed, I'm just going to hit it and let it repeat itself over and over again. God, just give me a nicotine lozenge. God damn it. God, no! Boomer lives! Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.